Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hello and welcome to the Irish Examiner podcast series on the Civil War. The year 2022, of course, is the centenary of the Irish Civil War, which brought us to an end the turbulent near decade of conflict that started with Easter 1916 and culminated with the birth of the state and the dispute over the Anglo-Irish Treaty signed in December 1921. In this series, we are examining various aspects of the war, characterised as pitting brother against brother, and which unfortunately at times descended into, and there's no other word for it, a form of depravity, with atrocities that killed many and left a bitter legacy. Today we're concentrating on the politics of the time, the divided Dáil, the attempts to avoid a split, and what emerged politically when the guns finally fell silent in the first half of 1923. Joining me to discuss the politics is a man who would be known to most of you as current affairs presenter and journalist, David McCullough, currently anchoring the RT61 television news. David is also a historian, and among the books he's written are two about Eamon de Valera and a biography of John A. Costello. De Valera, of course, whose role in the Civil War was a major issue for the rest of his life and had a big impact on his legacy, which we'll talk about. David's current book is The Great Irish Politics Book, which is aimed at informing a young generation of 8 to 12-year-olds all about politics. David, you're very welcome.
Thanks very much, Mick.
David, now, the split. The treaty is signed December 21. As I said, there is serious disagreement back in Dublin. There's a debate in January 1922, and then the anti-treatyites, led by De Valera, walk out. A split seems inevitable. There was, I think, though, serious efforts to patch things up and try to avoid what everybody feared was going to be a violent conflict.
Yeah, I mean, the important thing to remember about the walkout is that it didn't last very long. I mean, people will be familiar with this image, particularly it's used to great effect in Neil Jordan's movie Michael Collins, and they all walk out and there's shouting and haranguing of one side and the other. And that all happened. That's all absolutely accurate. But what people probably don't realise is that after lunch, De Valera and the Republicans came back into the chamber and they carried on. They carried on with a relatively civilised discussion. What had prompted the walkout wasn't the vote on the treaty. That had happened a couple of days before. And once the treaty was defeated, De Valera said, well, I'll have to stand down as President of the Republic. And Michael Collins said, no, don't do that yet. We don't want to lose your services to the nation. So both Collins and Arthur Griffith try and persuade De Valera not to resign. But De Valera says, no, we have to carry on in a logical and a constitutional way. I've lost a majority. I have to resign. But he then put his name forward for re-election. And he said if he was re-elected, that he would appoint a cabinet which was completely anti-treaty. So this would have, this in effect, if he'd won that election, it was in effect a second vote on the treaty a couple of days after the first. So the first vote on the treaty was supported by a margin of seven votes, 64 to 57. This second vote on De Valera's renomination as president was much, much closer. There were only two votes in it. De Valera himself abstained in a kind of a high-minded gesture, saying that he didn't really want power, and that abstention could have been very costly for him. Two others who had voted for the treaty didn't take part in this vote, they abstained, and two more changed sides. So they voted in favour of the treaty, but then voted in favour of De Valera. So anyway, long story short, he was only defeated by two votes. And at that point, the following day, Arthur Griffith's name was being put forward. And De Valera asked a couple of questions. What position would he hold? Would he be president of the Republic as De Valera had been? Would he defend the Republic and all the rest? And he got answers which seemed to satisfy him. And he said, well, I can sit here in this chamber while this vote has been taken because it's all perfectly proper. And then Mary McSweeney, a formidable deputy from Cork, sister, of course, of Terence McSweeney, who had died on hunger strike in 1920, got up and said, we will not have any cooperation with the so-called Free State. We will not support this government, which is trying to disestablish the Republic. And that drove De Valera to take a much harder line. So when the vote was called, he stood up and led his supporters out of the chamber. And as I said, then after lunch, they came back. They had a perfectly civil discussion about what would happen next. Arthur Griffith looked for an adjournment of the Dáil for a month so the provisional government could start its business. And De Valera agreed to that. And it looked at that stage as if they would find some way of proceeding without a resort to violence. And De Valera had spoken before the vote in the Dáil on the treaty about finding a definite constitutional way to resolve our differences. So he was talking about politics as the way forward. And it looked, at least at that stage, as if the politicians would find a way through. The problem was, of course, it wasn't just up to the politicians. There were other actors on the stage, principally the IRA.
Yes, and just in terms of the makeup of the Dáil, David, I saw somewhere that an awful lot of the TDs, or a certain number of them, Collins had specifically been involved in their recruitment, and he recruited a lot of them on the basis of that back in 1918-19. He would have viewed them as being very much on the pro-military side in terms of his vision of having to go to war with the British. And then he finds himself, having signed the treaty, that perhaps these lads are still a bit militant. I mean, is there something to that?
There is something to it. I think it's probably overstressed. I mean, remember when the candidates who have been selected, they have been selected by Collins and by Harry Boland. The two of them were very much a double act at this stage, particularly within Sinn Féin. So yes, for the 1918 election, they did look for people who were militant, who were advanced nationalists, as the term is sometimes used, who were committed to the Declaration of a Republic. And that then came to pass in January 1919. And you're right that many of the TDs had a military background. They're involved in the IRA, which was natural enough because they had come to prominence within the movement because of their prominence in the IRA or the volunteers as they were known before that. The other thing to bear in mind, though, is that a lot of them were involved in the IRB, the Irish Republican Brotherhood, the secretive underground organisation that Collins was in more or less in control of. And that IRB connection was very important for a lot of men who decided to support the treaty despite their Republican backgrounds. That, you know, and not just in the IRB, some of the military people who weren't involved in the IRB took the same line. It was what's good enough for Mick is good enough for me. So yes, there were lots of people in the Dáil who were far more advanced in their republicanism than the generality of the population, but there were also people who were swayed by other factors. And so you have the IRB link. You also have the military link, and there were quite a few IRA officers from inside and outside the Dáil, from parts of the country that the IRA was struggling in, that the IRA had never really got going. And they realised that if war was resumed, that they'd be in a very difficult situation. Different in Cork, different in Tipperary, different perhaps in Kerry, places where there had been a very strong IRA during the War of Independence, even stronger thanks to the increase in recruitment during the truce. And they saw things differently from a military point of view. They felt that they had the beating of the British, that they had enough men and that they had enough material. So people were making their choices on all sorts of different criteria. You know, was the Free State, the treaty, was it a step on the road, as Collins argued, or was it the final destination, as Cathal Brua and Eamon de Valera and others argued? They were also deciding it on the basis of the military situation and how it was likely to play out. So there was lots of different factors. You can't look at the breakdown in the vote on the treaty and ascribe it to just one thing. There was a whole multitude of factors.
Right. And thereafter then, I mean, at some stage after that, there was plans that there was going to be an election, which was effectively going to be seen as a plebiscite on the treaty. And in that context, and I suppose in the general political time, you had various meetings around the country. And at one of these, there's that occasion when Dev was quoted, and I'm not sure was he quoted exactly correctly, but making a reference to some extent that if necessary, they would wade through Irish blood in order to, I don't know, was it get the Republic or whatever?
Yeah, well, I mean, what De Valera was saying was, if you accept the treaty, that's the end of it. And that if the volunteers of the future wanted to complete the work of the volunteers of the present day, so if you wanted to get full independence from Britain, you'd have to use violence. But instead of fighting the British army, you would be fighting the army of the Free State. So you'd have to wade through Irish blood. That was one of a series of speeches he made at around that time, all more or less on the same line, saying if you accept the treaty, you will get a civil war, either now or at some stage in the future. Now, lots of people took that as a threat. Michael Collins certainly took it as a threat. He urged De Valera to stop what he called his incitements to violence. De Valera always claimed that it wasn't a threat, it was a warning. He was warning of what would happen. And Padraig O'Donnell, the veteran socialist Republican, once said, you might as well blame a rainy day on the weather forecaster as blame De Valera for the Civil War, which is a nice line, but, you know, a weather forecast isn't going to change the climate, but a political speech certainly can change the political climate. And certainly what De Valera's words did have an impact, and a very dangerous impact at that time. You mentioned the election and the terms of the treaty. The British expected an election very quickly after the treaty was ratified to create the Irish Free State government. And it was delayed, and it was delayed because of the treaty split. And De Valera was desperate to try and delay an election as long as possible, because he was well aware that the majority of the people would vote in favour of the treaty if they were given a choice. Now, he said that that was because of British pressure, and he certainly had a point in that. So he was trying to avoid an election. Collins and Griffith were desperate to have an election as early as possible for exactly the same reasons. They knew that public opinion would support them, not necessarily because they loved the treaty, but because they were tired of war in the main. And a lot of people, you know, just want a quiet life. If you give them the choice, do you want to continue a struggle with the British Empire, which may or may not lead to something slightly better than what's on offer, or do you want to take what you've got? A lot of people would say, let's take what we got, stop the fighting, stop the turmoil, and just get on with our lives. And that's, you know, a reasonable enough position for people to take. So there was this conflict about whether or not an election would take place. And Collins and Griffith were deeply concerned that if there was an election, if the IRA were still unreconciled to it, that they would disrupt it. There's already been cases of election registers being stolen and so on. And there was no way that you could run an election if the anti-treaty IRA was determined that you wouldn't be able to. So they needed some kind of an agreement. And what they came up with eventually was the what's known as the Collins-De Valera Pact, which was agreed in May in advance of the election in June. And that said that pro and anti-treaty Sinn Féin would put forward a panel of candidates in each constituency. So more or less 3-2 in favour of the pro-treaty side. And that once the election was over, that they would form a coalition government with a sort of pro rata distribution of seats. So De Valera thought this was great, this is a victory. Griffith thought it was a disaster. But Collins had secured something very important in the pact, not just the fact that the election could go ahead in relative peace, but anybody who wanted to would be allowed to stand as a candidate. So you have a panel election, but other candidates can take part. So in 20 of the 28 constituencies, voters had a choice. They didn't just have pro or anti-treaty Sinn Féin. They could vote for farmers, they could vote for Labour, they could vote for independents, all of whom, broadly speaking, were in favour of the treaty. So that completely upended the strategy of having a packed election, a fixed election, if you like. And the result was pretty emphatic. As De Valera said in the immediate wake of the election, we are hopelessly beaten. And if it weren't for the pact, it would have been much worse.
Yeah, it's interesting that he knew all along that in terms of popular opinion, in terms of any electorate, they weren't going to win. One aspect to that period, again, in the run-up to actually conflict breaking out with the shelling of the forecourts, David, is the role of the British. And I'm just referencing here the recent Civil War conference in UCC, the Taoiseach Micheál Martin, like yourself, a historian, spoke there. And I think this isn't the first time he made a reference to this, but he suggested about at this period that the British were very inflexible. And I just quote him here. Constant interference and inflexibility from London was central to the fact that nothing came of these efforts. Those were the efforts, as you said, for De Valera and Collins to ensure there wasn't a split. He said, the implied and open threats made to the provisional government directly escalated division and reinforced the views of those who questioned the good faith of London. Now, just a contra view and just what your opinion on it might be. Lloyd George and his colleagues had, in the context of the time, in the context of British politics and the Empire, gone pretty far with the Anglo-Irish Treaty, and it was thus thought by a lot of people, perhaps to the right within British politics. And they were under some flack back home for even signing the treaty. So what would it be too much to expect that they would have, for instance, agreed to what in some ways were concessions to the treaty signed in December when Collins and Griffith were over negotiating with them or explaining to them what was going on, that it was watering down the Anglo-Irish Treaty to some extent. Is it expecting too much to say they could have done more to ensure there wasn't a split?
I think it probably is. I think both the Taoiseach and yourself are right in your analysis, and one leads to another. Lloyd George had gone out on a limb. He had given Collins and Griffith more than most people in his government would have liked in terms of the treaty. And remember, Lloyd George is head of a coalition. He's the Liberal head of a government dominated by Conservatives who don't really like him. And there's increasing unrest on the Tory backbenches about his leadership. The 1922 committee, of which we hear a lot when there's a leadership heave in Britain, is called that for a reason. It was set up in 1922 to get rid of Lloyd George. So he is under pressure. There is a limit to how far he can go. And that leads to the British, to London, putting intense pressure on Griffith and particularly on Collins when it comes to the Constitution. And what Collins wanted to do with the Constitution of the Irish Free State was make it Republican enough to kind of blunt the edge of opposition from the anti-treaty side. And the British were determined not to let him get away with it. And their determination was increased by the fact that he'd agreed a pact for the election. And Churchill, who was colonial secretary at the time, much to the misfortune of Ireland, took the view that there wasn't really an election. And if there had been a real election, a real contest, the British would have been forced to maybe give a few more concessions to Collins to try and strengthen his hand. But seeing as there wasn't really an election, he felt that there was no particular need to do so. Now, the Constitution, in fairness, in Article 2, the Constitution says sovereignty derives from the Irish people. And then it goes on in a later Article 51, I think it was, to say that executive power is hereby given to the king. So if you were a sophisticated politician like De Valera was, you could have made great hay with that. You could have made an argument that we have sovereignty. We have won sovereignty. We are choosing to lend it to the British king for the purposes of this argument. And you possibly could have made an argument like that, but it didn't really arise. It was viewed, the Constitution was viewed as far too monarchical to satisfy anybody on the anti-treaty side. And it wasn't published anyway until the day of the election itself. So the British were putting an awful lot of pressure on Collins. And you can tell from his letters home from London how much pressure he feels. He feels that he's in this position because the anti-treatyites are running amok in the Irish countryside, robbing banks and all the rest of it. And therefore, he doesn't have a leg to stand on when he starts arguing with the British. But the British play a very important role in this, and you quoted the Taoiseach, and he's absolutely right, that they do share some of the blame for the outbreak of the Civil War, a very large share. I mean, we always concentrate on what Collins did and what De Valera did. The British played a key role here, and they're putting pressure on Collins all the time to take action against the Four Courts garrison, the anti-treaty headquarters in the Four Courts. Ironically, they get particularly irate when Sir Henry Wilson, the former Chief of the Imperial General Staff, at that time an Ulster Unionist MP, who was also an advisor to Sir James, security advisor to Sir James Craig's government. He's shot on the steps of his house in London, shot dead by two IRA men who are subsequently caught and executed. And the British immediately blame the Four Courts garrison where Rory O'Connor and the rest of the IRA executive have installed themselves in the heart of Dublin. And they demand action, and they write to Conlon saying, you must take action. This is a step too far. If you don't take action, we will. And remember, there are still British troops in Ireland. Plenty of them.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Neville MacCready, the Commander-in-Chief during the War of Independence, he's still there. He has thousands and thousands of troops. And he is ordered, after Wilson's assassination, he is ordered to attack the Four Courts himself. Now, MacCready, you could say many things about MacCready, but he wasn't an idiot. And he realised that the result of that would be to immediately reunite the pro and anti-treaty factions of the IRA, restart the War of Independence, and the whole thing starts again. So he doesn't refuse to attack the Four Courts, but he temporises. He plays for time. He sends one of his officers over to London to argue against. And eventually the British cabinet agrees that it would be pretty stupid for them to do it when they could get the provisional government to do it. So they put pressure and pressure and pressure on Collins. And Collins at the time is in the south of the country, tying up some loose ends from the election. And the Irish send a pretty dusty reply back to London. They say, well, what's your proof that that these two men were under orders from the Four Courts executive? The irony, of course, is that most people think, with good reason, no hard proof, but good reason, that the assassination was ordered by Michael Collins.
Yeah.
So the irony of it is that Collins is being ordered to take action against the Four Courts garrison because of something he did. And then the final straw that breaks the camel's back. Some anti-treatyites raid a car showroom on Bagot Street. Cars have been brought down there from Belfast. There's a boycott of goods from Belfast. So they think they're entirely within their rights to commandeer these cars. And while they're at it, along comes a couple of lorry loads of Free State troops who arrest them, much to the surprise of the anti-treaty side. So they're carted off to Beggar's Bush Barracks. That evening, Ginger O'Connell, Deputy Chief of Staff of the National Army, is sauntering home from the pub alone, unarmed, and he gets lifted by the anti-treaty forces who take him off to the Four Courts. So the Free State government, or the Provisional Government, as it still is at this stage, is faced with a simply intolerable situation. They're under pressure from the British anyway to take action. Now that the irregulars, as they would call them, have arrested their own deputy chief of staff. So that gives them both a spur to take action and also a good excuse to take action, because you can say to your Free State soldiers, you can say, look what they've done. They've arrested poor old Ginger. We can't have that. Now, whether the National Army would have been cohesive enough to take action because of the assassination of Sir Henry Wilson or not is an open question, but they could certainly do it because of this insult to the honour of the National Army.
Yeah, and it's interesting, Henry Wilson, that is the irony that for a long time, I think a lot of people said that it was Collins may have ordered. Now, Ronan McGreevy, Irish Times journalist, just written a book.
A very good
did
book.
An interview with him about it, yeah, and I'm not as sure that it was Collins, but
well,
certainly that was the thinking for
goes,
a long time.
He goes through all, it's a very good book, he goes through all the potentials for it. One, that the two lads acted on their own accord and he dismisses that. Two, that the Four Courts garrison did order it and he dismisses that because Rory O'Connor said, well, we didn't do it, but if we did, we would have proudly taken responsibility for it. Three, that Collins had ordered this during the the War of Independence and forgotten to rescind the order, which seems unlikely, or four, that he did order it. And the fact that Collins was up to all sorts across the border, trying to, the Northern campaign and all this, trying to undermine Sir James Craig's government. Wilson, perhaps wrongly, in some instances, was blamed for a lot of the anti-Catholic violence that was taking place in the North at the time. So it's entirely logical that Collins would have done it. Interestingly, Collins, this is from Ronan McGreevy's book, Collins sent two of his top men over to London to see if they could spring Dunn and O'Sullivan, the two men who were about to be executed. And about a year later, Dunn's parents had retired to Ireland, and they were living in a rented house in Bray. And there's a knock on the door, and it's Liam Tobin, Collins's top sidekick, who hands them the deeds of the house.
Jeez.
Now, if that's not some kind of recognition that they owed a debt to the Dunn family, I don't know what is.
Anyway, Cool. It's interesting. It will always be there. Just want to come to the Free State side, David Miller, but just briefly in terms of after the conflict breaks out, as you say, with the shelling of the forecourts, De Valera, as I understand, he signed up back as a private in his own regiment, and the anti-treaty side were under, I think, Liam Lynch. But over the following months, right up to the end of the year and into 1923, did he, as perhaps the political head of the anti-treaty forces, have much influence over the military men?
No.
Right.
He was completely sidelined, and he didn't like it one wee bit. As you rightly say, a couple of hours after the forecourts were shelled, he arrives into his office and he immediately starts saying, oh, well, we must try and find a way to find peace, and we get the Lord Mayor involved and all the rest of it. And Cathal Brua said, no, too late. These men have gone over to the British. We're going to fight them. And he signed on as a private again in the 3rd Battalion of the Dublin Brigade. Now, he didn't remain a private very long. He became a staff officer, but he was constantly urging Liam Lynch to allow him to form a Republican government. You'll have to imagine the air quotes there. To give a focus of loyalty, to give an aura of legitimacy to the anti-treaty side. And he's eventually allowed to do that in October. But he realises quite early on that they're not going to win this war. They can't win a war against a much better supplied Free State side. And if there is no hope of success, it would be immoral to continue. And he's constantly at Lynch arguing this. And Lynch clearly doesn't have any time for the argument and doesn't have much time for De Valera. But eventually he said, OK, you can set up a government. So he sets up this Republican government, which is, you know, entirely fictitious. It's one thing running an underground government during the War of Independence when you have the people on your side. It's complete make-believe when the people are not on your side, and they very much weren't on his side at this stage. So De Valera, he blows hot and cold about the prospects of success. He blows hot and cold about the tactics that are used, you know, execution of TDs and all that sort of thing. He's for it one day, he's against it the other. He really isn't in control of anything, and he isn't really in control of himself, I think, to some extent. But he's constantly thinking about the politics of it. He's constantly thinking of what comes next. We are going to be beaten in this. Lynch was completely obdurate. He refused to even consider a ceasefire. But De Valera is thinking, what terms could we find to reach a peace deal with the Free State government? What is the off-ramp, a phrase we've heard in relation to Ukraine lately? And he's also thinking about the future. There are going to be elections at some stage. We are going to put our argument in front of the people, and we do not have enough support simply among those who oppose the treaty. And even as early as January 1923, he's writing to Paddy Rutledge about reorganising Sinn Féin and widening its appeal. And he says, our aim is not to make a close preserve for ourselves, but to win the majority of the people again. I understand the difficulties, but we must teach our people to be broad in this matter. So De Valera wants to reach out. He wants to keep the Republicans who have opposed the treaty, obviously, but he also wants the support of the neutrals. And there are a lot of neutrals who refuse to take part in the Civil War. He also, at a slightly later date, wants to reach the people who supported the treaty on the basis of the stepping stones argument, that they thought it was going to lead somewhere, and that were disillusioned in the early years of the Free State. So this is his political strategy, and he's working on the political strategy even before the end of the Civil War. It's quite extraordinary that his mind is casting itself forward in a political way in this way. And that, you know, leads to the resurrection of Sinn Féin after he's released from prison. And it leads to Fianna Fáil. The whole point of Fianna Fáil was to reach a broader electorate, was to surpass civil war politics. So we hear a lot about a century of civil war politics. De Valera was trying to overcome that in 1926.
To know what's really happening, subscribe to the Irish Examiner today at irishexaminer.com/subscribe.
Rolling it back a small bit again to the conflict itself, David, and the other side, and that's the pro-treaty side. In August, in the space of 7 or 8 days, both Arthur Griffith dies, natural cause, unfortunately died young, a heart attack, and Michael Collins is assassinated or shot in Ballinabla on the 22nd of August. The absence of those two figures from the pro-treaty side, and I suppose trying to separate the reaction to Collins's killing is one thing, but the mere absence of them, would they have given what emerged as the government through the rest of the civil war a different character to the government? I mean, or let me put it another way to you. What evolved into Cumann na Gael, it's kind of difficult to see Griffith or Collins being comfortable in that kind of home.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, ironically, certainly in economic policy, Fianna Fáil was a lot closer to Griffith than Cumann na Gael ever was. Collins, I suppose, is this is the big question. What would Collins have done? And we can never tell. And there's a very good book about Collins by Anne Dolan and Will Murphy, which talks a lot about this. And we tend to project onto Collins our own political views, our own aspirations. I mean, I've seen Collins described as a proto-feminist, which he most certainly was not. I've seen, you know, people talk about, oh, Collins would have been much better on the economy and he wouldn't have had the penny-pinching approach that Cumann na Gael had. Well, there's no real evidence of that in Collins's time as Minister for Finance. He was very much a stickler for following the rules and accounting for every penny. You know, Collins would have done this, Collins would have done that. We simply don't know. And I think that's partly the reason for Collins's image being on such a high now in comparison to De Valera. De Valera, or indeed W.T. Cosgrave, both of whom had long political careers, which involves compromise, which involves disappointment, which involves, you know, failure to live up to early promise. Collins didn't have any of that. It's a pity he didn't have the opportunity to live on and to show what he could do. We can never tell what he would have been like, but certainly I think you're right that the Cumann na Gael that did emerge probably would have been very different under Michael Collins. Might have been more successful, might have been less successful. You simply don't know.
And W.T. Cosgrave, I mean, whatever way we look at it, they led that first government after the Civil War. They maintained and strengthened democracy over the period right up to when De Valera won with Fianna Fáil in 1932. And does he get the credit he deserves?
I think his reputation has increased somewhat in recent years. I mean, anybody who looks at that 10 years of the first government of the state, there's plenty to criticise, obviously, as there is with any government. They certainly could have done more in terms of helping the less well-off in society, although they were very strapped for cash. They were conservative in many ways. But there's a lot to credit as well. I mean, look at the Shannon scheme, the Ard na Cruach hydroelectric scheme, which De Valera opposed because he thought it was too expensive. Cosgrave's government pushed that through. It was a magnificent achievement. And if you look at the way that they developed and strengthened and furthered Irish sovereignty, even De Valera was prepared to admit in private that they had done a magnificent job in terms of pushing the boundaries of the Commonwealth as it was becoming, of securing more independence for the various dominions, including the Irish Free State. So there's a lot on the credit side, a lot on the debit side as well. But I think you're right that the key thing they did was to maintain Ireland as a democratic state. Now, oftentimes people say the best thing Cosgrave ever did was to hand over power to De Valera in 1932. I think it's a bit of a stretch to say, to praise somebody for not carrying out a coup. But it is true that there were firm foundations for Irish democracy, thanks in part to Fianna Fáil entering the Dáil in 1927. And W.T. Cosgrave certainly deserves credit for that.
Yeah, and finally, coming back to Dev, he emerged. A lot of people say he was very lucky he wasn't even captured, not to mind shot during the Civil War, because he was captured like others, like Erskine Childers. He would have been shot, most likely. But he did emerge. He became the outstanding, the major figure of certainly early 20th century, most of the 20th century in this country. You've written extensively about him, David. And as you know, a lot of people, particularly from the other tradition, blame him, rightly or wrongly, to the greatest extent, for being the reason behind the Civil War, or the man who was responsible for it. Did he ever share his innermost thoughts about that period, or reflect on any possible culpability, or express any regret about his role in what happened leading up to the Civil War?
I think you can tell that he had, I won't say guilty conscience, but uneasy conscience about it all, by the lengths he went to defend his position. If you were an historian who was unlucky enough to hove into earshot in his later years up in the Arras or wherever, he would go on at length to defend his position and to explain his position. And he tended to do that when he knew he was on a sticky wicket. There was one historian went up to the Arras to interview when he was president about the period of the Second World War, and he kept going back to the early 1920s, to the Civil War, to the treaty, to what happened. And he always defended himself. And I mean, he had a reasonable argument to make. He wasn't certainly solely responsible for the Civil War. He does bear some blame. We spoke about his reckless rhetoric earlier. He made mistakes. He made decisions which were unfortunate. So did lots of other people. We've talked about the British. Collins has a certain share of blame. Griffith. But particularly the people on the military side, Rory O'Connor, Liam Lynch, people like that. So there's plenty of blame to go around, and De Valera deserves his share of it. He wasn't solely responsible for the Civil War, but he gave an aura of legitimacy to the anti-treaty side, which he wouldn't have had earlier, and perhaps persuaded some people to oppose the treaty who wouldn't have done otherwise. So I think the Civil War probably went on longer and was more extensive than it might have been otherwise if De Valera hadn't taken the side that he did. I mean, imagine De Valera working the treaty, working the constitution with a united movement behind him. I think things would have moved a lot quicker than they did. So as an old man looking back on his life, and you can read the Longford and O'Neill biography, which is an autobiography in very thin disguise, and he was certainly unrepentant about what had happened, but I think at the back of it there was an uneasy conscience.
Yeah, finally, David, I mean, it's been described as not the most, or one of the most conservative revolutions of the period or whatever, but the other side of that coin is that the people like Cosgrave, De Valera and others around both of them, type of politicians they were, they did ensure that Ireland, the free state as it was, remained a democracy at a time, and we forget this going right through the 30s even, when democracy was very shaky and it was not anywhere near as widespread as it is now. That, from the point of view of politics, was a fair achievement.
It was, and you're right to credit both of them with it, and lots more beside. I mean, you look at all the new states that emerged from the Treaty of Versailles. The only one still standing as a democracy after the Second World War is Ireland, and that is an achievement. And that, partly that goes back to the deep roots of democracy that stretch back as far as Daniel O'Connell. And you can see it in terms of the Home Rule movement as well. People were involved, people were engaged, people took part. And that was the foundation on which Sinn Féin built in 1918 through to 1921. And despite the terrible lapse into civil war, politics was always in the background. They were always going to come back to politics once the civil war was out of the way, and that's why, as I say, De Valera was working hard on it. And the civil war, you described the depravity that was involved, and there were terrible things done on both sides. But if you compare it to other civil conflicts that happened around that time, like look at Finland. I mean, there were tens of thousands killed. Awful, awful, awful war. Or the Spanish Civil War sometime later. The Civil War was terrible. It was awful. It wasn't as bad as perhaps it might have been had it spilled over into a conflict with with the North. But still, we, you know, a century on, we look back and we can see that people made a difference, politicians made a difference in what they did, what they didn't do, what they said did have an effect.
Dave McCullough, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Mick.
I'd also like to thank our engineer, JJ Vernon. Thank you, folks, for listening to this podcast, one of our series commissioned for the centenary of the Civil War. We'll see you soon.